You're listening to Popaganda, a Bitch radio podcast. In this episode, recorded Thursday, November 10th at the Bitch headquarters in Portland, we're discussing Joan Didion's new memoir, Blue Nights, the Twitter hashtag Men Call Me Things, and the Childish Gambino album Camp, which comes out on November 15th. Just a warning, this podcast contains language that may be inappropriate for some listeners, including the word bitch, of course. Also, a quick note before we start, this podcast was recorded in two segments on the same day. So first you're going to hear me, Kelsey Wallace, talking to Julie Falk about Blue Nights, and then I'm going to switch to talk to Shirsten and Mac about Childish Gambino and the Men Call Me Things hashtag. Thanks so much for tuning in. Enjoy the podcast. Okay, I'm here with Julie Falk, and we are going to talk about the new Joan Didion memoir, Blue Nights. And before we get started, I think we're going to talk a little bit about Joan Didion and kind of who she is, because people are probably coming to this book with all different levels of experience with her as a writer. So, Julie, maybe you want to start by just saying how you first kind of became interested in reading her work. I should add, for people who are totally unfamiliar, she's now 75 years old, so she's been writing as a cultural critic and memoirist and fiction writer for, you know, upwards of five decades.
Well, I started reading Joan Didion's essays primarily about 15 years ago when I was exploring essayists and female essayists in particular. And so I went through her essays, and I tried her novels, but really wasn't engaged at all by the novels at the time. But also had kind of a hard time with the essays, too. I felt like, compared to some of the other female essayists that I was reading, her language of kind of detachment and her somewhat rarefied perspective on things was a little less engaging to me, as I was reading a lot of people who are more politically engaged or doing more telling of their life stories through their cultural critiques. So, but then when Year of Magical Thinking came out, I'd suffered a lot of death in my family and my husband's family recently, and it just felt like something I had to read, and everyone was talking about it. And I found myself really liking her in a way that I hadn't before, and really liking her writing, and I found a level of kind of engagement and intimacy with her writing in a way that I never had before.
Yeah, I think my experience echoes yours a little bit. Year of Magical Thinking really, you know, meant a lot to me too when it came out. I had just lost my dad, and it was just like, I just felt like some of the stuff she had to say resonated more than other things that I was reading at the time. And, you know, this memoir now, then Blue Nights, is about the death of her daughter, Quintana, which happened only shortly after the death of her husband, John Dunn, also a writer. So I think we were both looking forward to this because we both had, you know, really liked Year of Magical Thinking. And I think it's this Blue Nights is getting a lot of media attention, kind of not only because Joan Didion is a great writer and a lot of people in America pay attention to what she's writing, but also because, you know, Year of Magical Thinking was this kind of memoir about death. And then it's like, you know, there is kind of like a tabloid shock value of just like, oh my gosh, and did you know her daughter died too? Like, when the book came out, here's another book that's about that.
I felt so grateful that she wrote Blue Nights because, you know, the whole time I'm reading Magical Thinking, you know, knowing what, you know, the kind of unwritten ending was, I didn't expect this book to be written. And I didn't think that she would necessarily share with her readers her feelings about the death of her daughter. And so I was grateful that she wrote the book, both because I needed to know more. I needed to know the next chapter of the story, and also because it was a great gift, I think, for me to read her her reflections of motherhood and of loss of her child.
Let's talk about the book. Let's take a listen right now to Joan Didion herself reading a short excerpt from it on Fresh Air this week.
When I began writing these pages, I believed their subject to be children. the ones we have and the ones we wish we had, the ways in which we depend on our children to depend on us, the ways in which we encourage them to remain children, the ways in which they remain more unknown to us than they do to their most casual acquaintances, the ways in which we remain equally opaque to them, the ways in which our investments in each other remain too freighted ever to see the other clear, the ways in which neither we nor they can bear to contemplate the death or the illness or even the aging of the other. As the pages progressed, it occurred to me that the actual subject was not children at all, at least not children per se, at least not children qua children. Their actual subject was this refusal even to engage in this contemplation, this failure to confront the certainties of aging, illness, death, this fear. Only as the pages progressed further did I understand that the two subjects were the same.
I think, you know, she touches on some of the themes there, but the book, it's about the death of her daughter. It's also about just her feelings about, well, a lot of big topics, you know, illness, motherhood, frailty, failure, and there's kind of a lot woven in there about kind of her own personal feelings, but also larger topics that I think most people can relate to in some way or another. I'm interested to hear your thoughts because you do have kids. I was thinking, I don't have children. I don't know how her descriptions of what it's like to be a mother would resonate with someone who is a mother. So I'm interested to hear how they did.
Her feelings resonated with me quite a lot because in part, I desperately wanted children. And Joan Didion, although she didn't say that at all points of her life she really wanted to be a mother, at a certain point she very, very, very much did. And when she couldn't conceive and carry a child, she adopted Quintana. But I related to that, but I also relate very much to this feeling of there's these children in my life. I'm responsible for them. But I want to carry on my own life and don't want them to interfere with my work or my, you know, downtime at home. There's very often where I feel like I want a division between my life and my children's life. I think I necessarily kind of feel her guilt, but I also kind of hear her regret and her admonishments, and it made me really pause about the relationship I have with my children.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, one of the things that I really like about Joan Didion, besides just thinking that she's a really great writer, is that, you know, I at least get the sense that she's being just as honest as she can possibly be about her experiences. And I think this tide is turning a little bit, maybe partially because of online, you know, a lot of blogging coming from parents, but you know, this idea of just being really honest about how you feel about being a parent and about your children, even when it's not positive, I think still resonates with a lot of people because you're not used to hearing someone say, I feel like I might have failed as a mother, or I used to have, you know, dreams that I neglected my child because I was out in town at dinner and forgot about her, or I didn't pay as much attention to her when she was growing up as I wish I would have. And you know, we were talking a little bit about this earlier. There's a tone in the book that makes you feel as a reader like Joan Didion herself feels responsible for Quintana's death, even though, and I actually ended up having to Google exactly what happened because the book doesn't tell you exactly what happened, that she suffered complications from pneumonia that turned into a fever, that turned into an infection, that turned into a lot of hospital time, but it was not. I think there's the implication at certain points, especially because Quintana was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, that maybe it was self-inflicted in some way and that Joan Didion felt responsible. But I think, and this is partially informed by hearing her on Fresh Air, that her guilt mostly comes from the fact that, you know, she had a child that she couldn't protect from death. Not that she missed signs that Quintana was suicidal,
But I don't know. Did you perceive that tone?
Yeah, it was. I mean, to me, it reminded me of memoirs where the parent has lost a child to suicide, and I couldn't shake that feeling throughout the book. And you know, I feel like her guilt is almost indistinguishable from a parent who lost their child to suicide. I found it odd, in a way.
So
understandable, but odd in the tone of it.
Yeah, I think she has a sort of detached. I don't know. I agree. Like, it's hard to describe because she's, you know, she's detached in some of her descriptions, yet obviously so attached to the subject matter that it makes for an interesting perspective where it's, you know, she's able to kind of put herself under a microscope and say, here's where I should have noticed what was going on with Quintana more than I did. Here's where, you know, and I mean, it's Joan Didion, so she's got a skill level that allows her to weave in things like descriptions of what women were wearing in a photo of Quintana's christening, and it feels totally appropriate to talk about that and not at all off track. But, you know, it's like I'm talking about these things as a sort of impartial observer, yet on the other hand, the only reason I'm writing about this is because it is the single most affecting, you know, incident of my entire life, and she admits that all she thinks about all the time is her daughter, and that part of the reason that she wrote this book was to help her sort of deal with it and be able to move on to another project and not only think about this for the past 5 years.
Right. I think those details and those descriptions that she weaves throughout the book and that she repeats throughout the book, you know, the exact lines often throughout the book were really interesting to me. And I read that Christopher Hitchens compared her style in this book to almost, to Bob Dylan, into kind of a blues kind of rifting. But when I read that repetition, I spend more time, I've listened to a lot of Bob Dylan, but I spend more time reading children's books these days than I do listening to Bob Dylan. And for me, that kind of repetition of detail reminded me of children's books. And
I agree, yeah.
And I appreciated that because, I mean, it made me feel all the more we're talking about a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I thought that was really powerful. I mean, I will, you know, we're kind of dissecting the book without maybe we forgot to say that at least I really liked reading it. It's true to the subject matter and what my expectations were in terms of being pretty heavy experience. I definitely started crying at the end. I think maybe just because I had been like so emotionally kind of caught up in the book, and also just because, you know, I do find myself caring about Joan Didion as a person in a way that she would probably feel weirded out by because she doesn't know me. But, you know, just hearing her be so honest about her feelings, you know, I think she's such a great writer that it really worked. I recommend the book, but be prepared to not get a lot of laughs out of it if you're going to pick it up.
Yes, I thoroughly enjoyed it as well. And in fact, I would say, in many ways, I enjoyed the actual act of reading it more than I enjoyed The Year of Magical Thinking.
Interesting.
Though, in some ways, I think that The Year of Magical Thinking is a better book. And you certainly don't have to have read The Year of Magical Thinking to read Blue Nights, but I think together the two of them are more powerful than mm-hmm. either of them is on their own.
I was glad that I had the experience with The Year of Magical Thinking before coming into this, and also just the experience of reading Joan Didion when she's not being quite as personal. Mm-hmm. I like her so much that I was just happy to read this by her, even though it's a tragic tale. And really quick, before we wrap up, I want to recommend some additional online reading that I will include links to on our website. But Amanda Hess had a piece that I really liked this past week that was inspired by Blue Nights and also inspired by the death of Andy Rooney, kind of comparing what those two, Andy Rooney and Joan Didion, look like as, you know, she uses the phrase aging cultural critics, but, you know, this idea that Andy Rooney sort of grumped off into obscurity, like kind of shaking his finger at Justin Bieber and women wearing pants, and just became a sort of punchline because he refused to accept his place in the culture. Whereas Joan Didion, on the other hand, has remained, you know, a very relevant and beloved cultural critic, partially because she addresses her position as, you know, a woman in her 70s and is kind of turning some of her sharp cultural lens, you know, inward on her own life instead of trying to comment about, you know, what's up with Kesha or something. So, great article. And then just as a little more frivolous recommendation, the Ironing Board Collective, Thomas Page McBee had a piece about her fashion, Joan Didion's fashion, as like a classy, fashionable Californian over the decades that I really enjoyed seeing the photos of. I think fashion plays more of a role in Blue Nights than I thought it would. And it's interesting to get some of those visuals. I was hoping, that's one thing that I was kind of wishing as I was reading the book that I had, was some of the images, because she describes some pictures that I would have liked to see. Mm-hmm. But I recommend it. It sounds like you do too.
I do. And also, I'm not sure what the project is, but I believe it's her nephew, Griffin Dunn, who's doing somewhat of a documentary about Blue Nights. And it shows some of the footage from photographs, like at Quintana's wedding, and the peach wedding cake that Joan Didion refers to throughout the text. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to see some more visuals, that documentary is found online. We can link to that as well.
Oh, great. I do want to see them. I'm sure other people will too. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, I am here in the office with Shirsten Johnson and Mac Pogue, ready to talk about the Men Call Me Things hashtag and the sort of larger culture of harassment or harassment denial that we are currently finding ourselves a part of, and also the new Childish Gambino album, Camp. So let's get started with the Men Call Me Things hashtag. On Monday, Sadie Doyle, a bitch contributor and Tiger Beatdown blogger, and hashtag starter extraordinaire, wrote a blog post about the harassment that she's faced online and the way that she's been targeted since she started her blog 2 years ago. And in order to kind of draw attention to those issues and also kind of create a community around, you know, victims of online harassment, she started the Twitter hashtag Men Call Me Things. And it seems to have really resonated with a lot of people. It took off pretty quickly, and there's been a lot of really heinous stuff that you can read that people have been called online. But we think there's kind of more to discuss. So, Shirsten, what do you think about the Men Call Me Things hashtag? Do you feel, I guess what I kind of want to get at is, you know, why has this resonated with so many people? But then also, does this seem like the right way to go about creating community over this issue or drawing attention to it? What do you think?
Well, what I like about it is that it gives people a chance to air publicly things that have happened to them, which I think is a really powerful thing for, like, if something bad happens to you, if you've been harassed, I think it's really useful to see that it's happened to other people, that you're not alone, that I think, especially in the case of online harassment, I know personally, like, it makes me feel better. I'm like, this isn't just me. It sort of makes all, like, the trolley comments a little less hurtful to know that there's sort of, like, this blanket harassment happening to everyone. And I think there is sort of, like, a cathartic thing to share it and to sort of take it back. And but on the flip side, the hashtag itself, as other people on Twitter have pointed out, trans bloggers and bloggers of color have pointed out that there is harassment from not just men. When questioning transphobia, they tweeted that they've gotten plenty of harassment from cisgendered women. And so the hashtag itself could be expanded a little bit so that it's not just sort of like a men versus women thing. But I think that would help it get at larger and more inclusive issues of online harassment. But I think it's good that people are talking about online harassment.
I've seen a little bit of a response, not necessarily a pushback, although certainly there are
people who are pushing back against this, but response from men saying, you know, this is kind of off-putting to me that, you know, it's not like, it's not a specific type of men call me things in the hashtag, which we know is true. It's like men who are harassing women, or not even just men, people who are harassing other people are who's calling people things. I think Sadie Doyle chose to use the men call me things hashtag because it speaks to sexism and a patriarchal culture. On the other hand, I'd be interested to hear from you, Mac, as a male. Do you feel like maybe, how do you feel about this conversation happening considering that men call me things is what this hashtag is?
I definitely did feel like just confining it to the sort of sex-based approach did deny a lot of people questioning transphobia said. It denied them the power of using it to say that, you know, a lot of women and, you know, people that should be sort of on their side are part of this issue. It's not just a male-based issue. While the issue of anonymous harassment is definitely huge, I thought, coming from my experience, it also happens from not just sort of men from a distance, but people that, you know, we may be sort of closer with than just, like, anonymous online harassers. You know, I feel like I've had, like, people I know call me things for sort of the work that I do, and I think, while it's not the same sort of culture of this sort of sniping from afar, I think that sort of just calling it like this sort of broad, you know, men at a distance call me things sort of denied a lot of the power of people that are, and like people more intimately involved with you than just, you know, anonymous harassers.
Yeah, I think a couple of people involved with the campaign got at this, where there is sort of like a more subtle harassment, where it's like, maybe I haven't been called like these terrible things, I haven't been threatened with rape, no one has said that they know where I live, but there are these really subtle ways that people who write about issues online are taken down a notch. And that can happen from people you know. Mm-hmm. It can sort of serve as like a backhanded compliment, but actually undermining what you say. And there's just a lot of different levels to online harassment that I think people are looking at.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know, and this is just my own personal experience because that's what I have to offer. Reading some of the tweets and kind of reading what people have to say, at first when I saw this, I just thought, oh my gosh, I feel so bad for these people who've been harassed online, kind of not necessarily identifying myself with it. And then, you know, as you're reading the tweets, I thought, I don't know why I didn't, like, I don't know if I have just kind of, like, because we all work online and you kind of have to distance yourself from this kind of talk or you wouldn't be able to keep working. Like, if I just kind of don't consider myself someone who deals with harassment, and then you're reading kind of what some of these examples are, like, oh, someone told me to shut up, somebody said I was a bitch, like, somebody told me to fuck off, and it's just like, yeah, all that stuff has happened to me this month, probably to everyone here, you know, and yeah. I think there's something, I don't think that it's specific to feminism, I don't think it's specific to being women, but I do think it has to do with, you know, what happens when you kind of call out a power structure, you critique something that other people have a real kind of vested interest in keeping you quiet on, that does really bring a lot of harassment to the forefront, and it's really unfortunate. And, you know, I think we've identified some of the issues with the hashtag itself. And I do think also, and maybe this is just the kind of latent Luddite in me that thinks, like, while Twitter is a great place to have conversations like this because so many people can get involved and a hashtag is a very easy way to organize things, it's hard to have a more nuanced discussion going on when 140 characters is all you get. Mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, it's not necessarily the right forum to really get at, like, the underlying cause of some of these issues. Mm-hmm. It's more just like we can kind of feel a sense of solidarity because I can see that other people are dealing with the same issues, which I agree with Kirsten, that is valuable. Mm-hmm. But something that kind of struck me that I was hoping that we could sort of work into the conversation is some of the response to this from, you know, D-bag harassers who are not even necessarily saying, like, shut up, don't have this conversation because you're awful or something, but more, like, it's more a sense of dismissing the entire issue. Like, online harassment isn't a problem, you're just whiny, and I think, you know, we can't help but draw comparisons to, like, the Herman Cain sexual harassment allegations that are happening in the physical world, where, you know, last night in the Republican presidential debate, people started booing when the moderator brought up the sexual harassment allegations he's facing, not because, like, not in a way that it was just, like, he's innocent, but in a way, like, we don't think that this is a relevant topic to this debate. Basically, I feel like harassment in general right now is getting framed as something, like, a frivolous issue that we shouldn't give a shit about.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. And that's just really dangerous to me and feels newer to me. I mean, it feels like we've actually slid pretty far backward on when it comes to harassment. I was reading an article on Slate that was kind of like the way that the right wing is kind of denying harassment as a thing compared to 20 years ago when they were like attacking Anita Hill as being a liar. Now it's like, I've got a way we can take this even further. Let's attack harassment as a topic and say that, like, you're stupid if you even bring it up.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really unfortunate and depressing.
I mean, they're both ways of, like, silencing victims of harassment.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just manifesting themselves in different ways. But, I mean, it's good that we can sort of have them to compare each other to. I think that they help illuminate each other, but it's both just sad state of affairs.
On a different note, let's talk a little bit about the our next topic, which is the new Childish Gambino album, Camp. And Childish Gambino is the rap name of Donald Glover, who is a comedy writer and performer. He currently stars on NBC's Community and also is a stand-up comedian. And he has been rapping under the name Childish Gambino for a few years now, but this is his first full-length studio album that is officially for sale. Up until now, he's been just kind of releasing songs for free online for fans, and this is kind of his first official project as Childish Gambino. And, you know, I don't even know where to start.
Kelsey's been talking about it since, like, Monday.
I've been talking about it since Monday when, of course, I'm so typical. It's like, it got put up on NPR First Listen, and I was like, ooh, you know. I think I was pushy about talking about this for Popaganda because I was particularly struck because I assumed wrongly that this was going to be some sort of novelty album because he's a comedian. And, like, his sort of his version of Eddie Murphy's Party All the Time or something. And it's just, it is not at all. Clearly, it's a project that he takes very seriously. And he is a smart writer who is saying a lot in mm-hmm. his music. And it's really complicated. We've been talking about it a lot. So, first of all, I just want to hear, because I foisted it upon both of you to listen. You know, what did you think of the music? Did you enjoy listening to it? Was it as compelling to you, or did you feel like you were kind of didn't care?
It was compelling to me. I thought he was talented. It reminded me very much of a Kanye West album for many reasons, but I think musically, definitely that it's very Kanye West. And I like Kanye West, so musically. Mm-hmm. So that did appeal to me. And even with your knowing Kelsey's opinion beforehand, I thought, I'm sure we'll get into more detail, but I thought he said a lot of stuff about challenging, like, racial norms and society's expectations of black men and some stuff.
Just, like, the beats and his wordplay, which a lot of people love to talk about as only wordplay and not anything more on the Think Progress article. I thought that it was really fascinating and enjoyable to listen to, just from a musical standpoint, at least.
Yeah, and, you know, you mentioned Think Progress. There was an article last week by Alyssa Rosenberg on Think Progress about the misogyny in the lyrics, and we don't need to get into necessarily that article right now, but I would like to talk about the lyrics a little bit more, if we can. Clearly, you know, there are lyrics in the music that talk about objectifying women, you know, having sex with a lot of different women, like, threatening
using
women.
Bitch not in an empowering way.
Yeah, using
way.
Bitch not in an empowering way. It's problematic. I don't think any of us want to give him a pass right now.
No.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that when someone, and, you know, I have a complicated relationship with Kanye West's lyrics too. I think the comparison is apt, because when someone is being very conscious and very kind of self-deprecating and self-reflexive and talking about, like, here I am as a person in society, here's what people's expectations are of me, like, here's a sort of meta-analysis of my processing of that, and here's what that looks like.
Yeah, but Kanye's douchebag song.
Yeah, Runaway, Monster.
Childish Gambino also is like, I know what I'm saying, it makes me an asshole. Like, I know it. What I do makes me an asshole.
Right, and so I think an analysis of the lyrics, while we don't need to give him a pass, like, does need to take into account the fact that he's also aware of what's problematic about this, but then how do we deal with that? I mean, mm-hmm. how do we decide? And I think really quickly, let's listen to an excerpt from the song Backpackers, which I felt was especially self-reflexive, mm-hmm. Just so you listening at home can analyze along with us. And just a warning, the lyrics are explicit. It's got some swear words. So here we go.
Just to set this clip up a little more, the album Camp doesn't come out until November 15th, so we're about to listen to a live version of the song Backpackers from the Pitchfork Music Festival this summer. Oh, yo, it's Childish, baby, Mr. Talk About His Dick Again. Nerdy ass, black hair, whatever, man, I'm sick of him. That well spoken token who ain't been heard. The only white rapper who's allowed to say the N word. I buy a bunch of them and put it on my black card. Now I got some street cred, use it till it's maxed out. I got a girl on my arm, dude, show respect. Something crazy and Asian, Virginia Tech. She too fine, I'm too dimes. If not that, I'm walking out with 2 5s. Change my ID for the cops, it's not enough yet. Black male in short shorts, I'm double suspect. Ballin' since 83, half of them say gay. Maybe that's the reason I like lady what babies say. I'm a problem, but I'm lame as fuck, homie. But I rap like these niggas ain't got shit on me. Fuck the cool kids, Chuck Ng. Let's not people who think that hating on me makes them distinguish. Like, what is this nigga doing? Rap is for real black. I hate that fucking faggot, man. You think that he failed at? Or I wrote on rape culture my junior year at Brown, so I'm allowed to say what all his raps are about. Better shut your mouth before I fuck it. You really hate my lyrics now? Or Kid Cudi's, nigga? Thing, money insane, busy getting brain like crane. What's my name in the hood? Got these niggas using MapQuest. Yo, fuck these backpackers. So, kind of wonder where we go with our response to something that is this self-aware. Does that make it cool to say, like, I'm gonna, you know, I'm acknowledging that you have issues with me because of my race, because of my position in society, like, here's how what I think about it, but I'm also going to call you a bitch and tell you that I'm going to come on your face. Is this cool to do? I mean, I don't,
yeah.
And I don't know if it's, I also don't feel like as a non-black person who doesn't know him at all, that it's my place to necessarily analyze it, which is why, you guys, this is so complicated. So somebody help me. Somebody jump in and help me.
I mean, yeah, you have to give him credit for saying this is who I am, this is where I am coming from. I don't feel like there was a comparison made to Odd Future in the Think Progress piece that seemed a little off base to me, because Odd Future seems a little...
To me, they seem like they're completely lacking in self-awareness, yeah. Or caring about analysis of... I mean,
yeah.
Maybe that's my bias against Odd Future, because I think Tyler, the creator, seems like a turbo douchebag, but it just, I don't get the sense that they're inviting this kind of a discussion. They're more just trying to elicit a reaction, where I feel like, mm-hmm. I get the sense, and maybe it's because I am the audience member that Childish Gambino sort of lampoons in some of his lyrics, but also is maybe speaking to, that's like, you are probably paying attention to me because I make pop culture that is palatable for white people.
Because you like Troy on Community because he's friends with A-Rod.
Right, and it's like, I'm going to make a clever Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles reference and, you know, make an E.E. Cummings joke. And we can all just get so meta and postmodern together, but I'm also going to tell you to fuck off because you are not in a position to make a judgment about my life experiences, and it's just...
I think maybe we just have to, like... I mean, we can't, like, let it drop that he says messed up stuff about women, but to sort of, you know, hold him accountable for that, but also recognize that he's talking about other issues as a black man.
I think he does have some, you know, interesting and maybe, like, enlightening thoughts just on, you know, everyone's expectations of him. Because, I mean, it was kind of hard separating the whole Childish Gambino from Donald Glover.
Which, by the way, do we want to get even more meta and just, like, down the rabbit hole with this? His rap name came from a Wu-Tang rap name generator online. Where you put in your name and press refresh and they give you a rap name and then he used that.
Wow.
Just like, this is just, somebody please do a master's thesis on it. I want to read it.
I think he's already started his master's thesis.
Remember the lyric when he's like, I want someone to say that James Franco is the black Donald Glover?
Or the white Donald Glover.
That's what I meant.
Also, I do think that it's a good rap album, you know? And I have a complicated relationship with rap music because I really like rap music. And I know that it's problematic in a lot of ways. So I'm coming to this with that, but I think, you know, from a production value standpoint and just, like, a rap lyricist, I really like listening to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just thought it was interesting, kind of stepping back from, like, I can't even begin to process everything that's on the album, but I can sort of process what some of the people are saying about it. Some of the, like, Think Progress commenters talking about, you know, how... he's this just, like, lovable nerd, sort of, and how that's sort of this thing that should get, give him a free pass, and, like,
mm-hmm.
he's got this, like, nerd persona, but then there's this weird anti-nerd backlash of people saying that nerds are the most misogynistic people just because people don't expect it, and so I just think it's interesting how he sort of plays with that character or with that sort of stereotype on the album. I mean, he constantly references how now that he has money, people want to talk to him and people want to have more sex with him now that he's not a nerd. And so it's this weird sort of, I don't know, it's something that I haven't, you know, experienced ever before, but it's this weird sort of, like, revenge album in that weird way, where he's just, like, horribly insulting everyone now that he has money.
Yeah, there's, you know, and then there's also, like, not to spend an hour talking about it, just, like, a very sort of salient critique of masculinity and... the, you know, the meta speaking song at the end of the album talking about,
which,
like,
if, I feel like if you listen to it, you have to listen,
you've got
to
make it to
past,
the end,
these last 5 minutes,
get all the way to the end.
It's pretty incredible.
Just, you know, talking about what it means to make your personal experiences public and why, what sort of past experiences might lead you to that, and kind of what it means to transition from boyhood to manhood, and how he feels like he hasn't made it there yet. And it's, you know, it's interesting. I know that I am just, like, I'm writing my own page in the Stuff White People Like book by saying this, but it's true. I'd encourage people to, you know, listen to it with a critical ear. I think he's inviting that, but, and you know, and I don't think we should give him a pass for saying offensive stuff, but I think it raises good questions and makes for interesting conversation. Okay, well, that being said, let's get to our bitch faves. I will go ahead and start because I'm seeing some facial expressions that you might need a second. I, just to keep this rap train rolling, was very saddened to hear about the death of Heavy D this week. I'm sure many other listeners feel the same. And I revisited the Nothing But Love music video that I have very fond memories of watching when I used to, like, babysit, you know, when I was, like, 13 and it was on MTV, and it just really held up as a really fun video to watch. It just really gives you a great sense of just, you know, what a great kind of presence Heavy D had and what a great dancer he was and how fun his lyrics are and how great the song still sounds. And so I'd recommend checking that out again if you haven't seen it in a while. It totally brightened my day.
I recently came across sort of like a little handbook / zine / little paper book that Poor Magazine put out about sort of in response to the Occupy movements, and they're based in the Bay Area, so it's sort of heavily, you know, it's centered on Oakland and San Francisco, but It's called A Decolonizer's Guide to a Humble Revolution, and really gets at a lot of the decolonization mindset that is lacking from a lot of Occupy movements from the perspective of the disenfranchised. So I would go to Poor Magazine's website to check out how you could get a copy and seek it out, because even though it's Bay Area focused, there's a lot of stuff that applies to cities around the country.
Great.
I'm a huge fan of Twitter, and but I have a really hard time finding just like funny Twitter accounts without them posting something really problematic about once a week or so. But I have stumbled onto the account of John Werster, the drummer for Superchunk. Now that I know that I'm saying this, he's probably going to post something really awful. But so far, if you like punk music or metal music and making fun of it, if you like hearing Danzig as a bunch of punchlines, John Werster has got it going on. And so keep it up, please, John Werster, because you're doing a good job.
All right. Great recommendations. Okay, well, thank you so much for talking to us. And thank you for listening. You can find more audio offerings from us at bitchmedia.org/audio.
Thanks for tuning in. Bitch Media is a nonprofit organization, and we rely on your support. Visit bitchmedia.org/donate to find out how you can get more involved, and email us at radio@b-word.org with your feedback.